Very good. So all the important people are in now. And if somebody hears me when I come in, I get into big trouble. So welcome to this morning's talk. And for this morning's talk, I'm taking up a little subject, a nice question which was asked last night about the meaning of sati and sampajanya. Oops. And sati sampajanya. Now they know who the unimportant people are. I mentioned that mindfulness, the word for sati, which is also part of memory, always goes with wisdom, either sati sampajanya or sati panya. You never find mindfulness just used by itself. Yeah, it can be defined separately, but it always comes across in the practice of a person mindfulness always comes along with some type of wisdom, some type of understanding and knowing. And it's not just being aware of what you're doing, but also why you're doing it. What's the purpose of this? And also, what are the dangers, and how can you avoid the dangers of whatever it is you're doing? So it's always mindfulness and wisdom, they always go together. And the more you're mindful, the more that wisdom grows. The more that wisdom grows, the more you have less problems, the more still you are. The more still you are, the more aware you become. So these three things support one another. Mindfulness, wisdom and stillness. And that means that we have a nice path. You don't expect to be wise at the very beginning. And in fact, so many people think they are wise. And it turns out they're not seeing deeply enough. What sounds true to you on the surface, if you look deeper, there's a better way of looking at it. And a good example of that is the saying, one day we will all die. Can you find fault with that? I can. One day we will all die. And a much better view is, most days we don't die. In other words, one day we will die. Sometimes misses a point. It's like seeing the two bricks in the wall. But most days, we don't die. And that great pearl of wisdom, of course, came from one of the great sources of Dhamma, the cartoons in the newspaper, and that was from Peanuts. You great, some amazing pearls of wisdom. Especially my favorite cartoon strip, Calvin and Hobbes, where Calvin said, the clearest, most convincing sign that there is extraterrestrial intelligence. He said, this is so convincing that there is intelligent life in the universe, is that they haven't come to visit Earth yet. Because they're too intelligent to come to this crazy house. And yeah, who would come to visit this place if they were intelligent? You have to be nuts to come and visit Earth. So superior intelligence, you know, we keep far away from this place. So little pearls of wisdom, sometimes it's seeing deeper than the superficial, which is one of the reasons why that wisdom is one of the hardest things to define. It's the hardest thing to actually develop. And sometimes it's the most important thing that we have to let go of. Our old wisdom. Because sometimes it's our old wisdom and ideas which block us from seeing the truth. Here we go, this wonderful little anecdote, which again some of you heard before, but it's a wonderful anecdote about how wisdom can be perverted. And this was told to me by my old friend I caught up with a couple of years ago, Bernard Carr, professor of theoretical physics at Queen Mary College, a close disciple of Stephen Hawking's, who was actually, he only told me that he was actually featured on the film about Stephen Hawking's. He was one of the characters there. He didn't play himself, got an actor to play him, but at least he got on the red carpet for the premiere in London. And he was also one of my best mates from my time at college in Cambridge. And in fact, there must be some connection we have together, because I like to tell the anecdote that he was the first Buddhist I ever met. When I became a Buddhist at the age of 16, just reading books, and I was too stupid to actually look for a temple. What I need to do is look at the telephone directory, B for Buddhist, and find something. But I didn't know that, so I thought I was the only Buddhist. I didn't know how to make contact with any other Buddhist. I never saw a Buddhist monk walking the streets. But when I went to university, they had what was called Society's Fair, where it was in the Corn Exchange, this big old building in the centre of Cambridge, and every society, every club, sporting, weird club, they always had their stall there trying to get members. They had the Flat Earth Society, the Hare and Hounds, which was fox hunting, tiddlywinks, psychic research, ghost hunting, I joined that one, and also the Buddhist Society. And when I saw that, if you can actually imagine, you know, you're really getting into Buddhism, reading books, but you didn't know what to do next. And then, totally surprised, there was a club for Buddhists at the university. And I was just so sort of excited. And I went to the stall. There was a young student behind the stall. I said, I want to join. He said, you don't have to. No, Buddhism isn't evangelical, but sometimes it goes too far the opposite way. Actually stops you from joining. And that's what he did. He said, no, you don't have to. And I said, I want to. No, just come and see. Ahipasiko. If you like it, then you can join. And I got the joining fee, £1, and slammed it on the desk. Join me. That was really quite aggressive. And that was Bernard Carr, you know, later became a professor. So we were great friends. And I'd go back, you know, all those years. I've got some nice little stories about him. But anyway, that he was not only a top theoretical physicist, but also he was into psychic research as well. We would go ghost hunting together. And when he was, latest, I think he was the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. That's been going for about 150 years now. And these are scientists. These are not crazy people who do this research. And he told me this amazing experiment. If you haven't heard it before, you should do. If you have, it's worth hearing again. Done over in Imperial College in London. Actually, you, Phil Badder, you actually checked it out, didn't you, and found out the reference for it. And in this experiment, the professor, he told all his colleagues that he was going to do a demonstration of levitation. And number one success of this professor was to get all his colleagues to actually come in and attend. Levitation is against the laws of physics. But still, all these lecturers, researchers and professors in the field of physics actually attended. And the demonstrator came into the room with a flower pot. And he put the flower pot on the laboratory bench. If you've ever been to a university, a science lab, you see a big bench on the front. He put it on there, no strings, no wires, and he said, now we're going to levitate this flower pot. And he had video cameras, other stuff on there, so if it worked, you have evidence to record it. And the second great success of this guy, must have been a marvelous salesman, he got all these professors, he said, I need some atmosphere to be able to levitate this flower pot. I need you all to start chanting, Om, Om. Now, it'd be hard enough to get professors of physics to do that in UWA, here in Perth. To get that done in London, stuffy old professors, it was actually an amazing achievement. So he had all these professors and lecturers, please correct me if I've got it wrong from what you read.
You've got it wrong, but But yeah. It makes a good story. So.
Okay, but they did do the Om, didn't they? Okay, anyway. Never allow the truth to stand in the way of a good story. So they're all chanting Om, 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 Om. And that's when the flower pot rose in the air. Correct? That's correct, see. And as the flower pot rose into the air, it was amazing. It actually worked in front of all these researchers, top physicists and other scientists. Wow! It had been proved. And after the experiment was finished, they asked some of the professors, and at least one of them said it never happened. It didn't rise above the table. Even though they had video evidence that it happened, he said, no, it never happened at all. And the reason was because it was an experiment in psychology. How if something goes so against your worldview and your wisdom tells you it can't happen, you don't even see it. It doesn't appear in your conscious awareness. So the whole idea of like bare awareness, not our bare awareness, this is the correct bare awareness, the understanding that you can trust your basic perceptions is false. Just what appears to your mind has already been filtered and sometimes exaggerated. So you literally see what you want to see and you can't see, you can't hear, you can't know what goes too much against your world views. That's the trouble with wisdom. We all think we're wise because we see it, we feel it. But it's already been filtered out. And the reason that the professors chanted Om was because it was a trick. It wasn't real levitation. The purpose of the experiment was the psychology of it. The psychic research to say, if you see a ghost, if there's a ghost right in front of you, if you think ghosts don't exist, you just won't see it. So it was an experiment on perception. But the reason they did the Om, because underneath the bench was a really strong electromagnet, which actually, you know, raised the flower pot up in the air. And if you ever know very, very strong electric machines, when you turn on a very, very strong current, you can always hear it. The current makes everything hum. And the Om chanting was to mask the fact that a huge electric current had just been turned on. Otherwise the game would be up, the trick would be uncovered, and the experiment wouldn't work. But major part of the experiment, and one of the reasons I quote it often, is how we can't even trust our senses. Because they've already been filtered before we even know it. So, wisdom, mindfulness. Do we really know that what we're seeing is true? And of course the other experience of that, which you all know, the old elephant and the seven blind men, all feeding a different part of the elephant. I won't go into this for too much detail because you've all heard it so many times. The one who felt the legs thought it was a tree trunk, the one who felt the tail thought it was a fly whisk and so on. And they always argued with each other. Who was right, who was wrong? Who was right? They were all right because they all had personal experience, but not the full experience. So one of the problems with wisdom is we don't have a full experience, we've only got partial experience, and even what experience we have could be distorted. So wisdom is a very, very, very tricky thing. And of course, if you hadn't heard this one before, about the elephants had heard that story so often as well. So one day there were seven blind elephants. And they were talking together, what's a man, what's a man, what's a man? Because they were blind since birth, the elephants had never seen a man before. So they decided to, you know, do the same thing which the blind men did to find out what an elephant was. They all decided, let's go and find a man each. Let's go and just an experiment. And when we come back from feeding the man, we can actually compare notes. And so all the seven blind elephants, they all found a man each and they all came back. And unlike human beings, they all agreed what a man was. They said a man was flat. Because the only way an elephant can feel a man is with his legs, and they were not sensitive at all. So they all agreed, oh, men and women as well, were fat when an elephant feels you. So anyway, you know, I told that joke to Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard years ago over in Hayman Island, a long time ago. Anyway, that was, I've gone downhill ever since then, if I was ever up in the first place. But there, that was actually just the problems with wisdom. And so, how can we trust that our mindfulness and wisdom is going in the correct direction? And this, one of the wonderful things you read in the Buddhist suttas, sometimes just little sentences, little anecdotes, you realize that it's very, very powerful. And this one was the advice the Buddha gave to the first bhikkhuni, Mahaprajapati, which he also repeated to the Arahat Vinaya expert, Upali. And it was when Venerable Upali, you know, he'd done all his work, getting all the rules and discipline all in order, and he asked the Buddha, at the time I went off on a retreat, can you give me some Dhamma, you know, for my seclusion? And the Buddha said exactly what he said to Mahaprajapati. He said, whatever leads to renunciation, letting go, not attainments, but letting go, which leads to peace, to stillness, upasama, the synonym for samatha, which calms things down, which leads to knowledge, seeing things truly, which leads to awakening, which leads to enlightenment. Those are the things which are the teachings of the Buddha, which are the Dhamma. Very, very powerful. He didn't say what the Dhamma actually is, not its content, but he was focusing on its results. If it does lead to you to letting go of things, having less possessions materially and spiritually, especially having less ownership of the past and less fear of your future, that renunciation, that is a sign that that's a teaching of a Buddha. If it leads to upasama, peace, which is not your father, Analia. Upasama, he's a monk over in Bodhidharma Monastery, he got the name Upasama. We always have names we try and live up to. Sometimes it takes many years, but we're trying. Who tries to be nice and calm and still and peaceful. If it leads to calm and stillness, then that's wisdom. If it leads to more argument and agitation, it's not. And if it leads to, they say, jnana, just seeing things yourself, if it leads to sambodhi, awakening, and remember, don't call that enlightenment, because they have another word for enlightenment, comes afterwards. Sambodhi, awakening, and then eventually to nirvana, things just vanishing, disappearing. So that's the teaching of the Buddha, that's the Dhamma, you can know that for sure. So how can we use that? So I developed a simile which explains that from an anecdote in my life when I, again, student times, I've only lived 65 years, so there's only a certain number of anecdotes. Most of my life was boring and stupid, but every now and again you did something useful, and I used those useful moments for anecdotes. And this useful anecdote was during vacations, summer vacations especially, I did seek some solitude, it was very cheap, to go up into the mountains of Scotland with a backpack and a tent and live for days in the mountains by myself, meditating and just basically being simple. So, on one occasion, staying to get some shower and a few things in a youth hostel in a remote part of the northwest of Scotland. And one morning after finishing my breakfast, there's only two or three people in the hostel, so the warden of the hostel invited me to go for a walk up one of the mountains. It was a lovely day, so yeah, sure. So we walked to the top of the mountain, And when we got to the top of the mountain, it was such a wonderful day, there was another mountain not far away, so let's go to that one too. And the warden said, one mountain a day is enough for me, I'm going home. And I always blame that warden, because he was a local person, he should have known better. You don't go walking in the mountains by yourself. You could trip, break a leg, and you wouldn't be able to get help for days. So, a big mistake of him, but I wasn't scared because it was a beautiful, cloudless day. So I went walking up to the other mountain, and as I walked, clouds came in from the North Atlantic. As I got higher up the mountain, there's lots of clouds, but they were high up. And as I got close to the top of the mountain, the clouds descended. And I couldn't believe how fast this happened. Within a few seconds, I was enveloped in the cloud, in mist. And I couldn't see my hand at the end of my arm. It was really thick mist. And I thought, oh yeah, it could be dangerous. But I thought I had a sense of direction. Just turn round and go back the way you came. So I thought. But human beings do not have a sense of direction. Don't blame your wife for getting lost. You get lost too. I know many cars, if you're driving, have not just a GPS but a GPW. Global Positioning Wife. Who always tells you which way to go. Unfortunately, that's true. I've been in cars, I've seen it. So, I always thought I knew my directions, but I did not. And I was wandering in the mist, and I came literally just one and a half steps away from not being here. There was this vertical cliff, goes down a long way. And I, one more step, and I would have fallen over it. Had a big heavy backpack, and I did have a backpack on. So, but, you know, it was that far away, it's all I could see, and I just got that close and saw there was a huge drop there. And when I, you know, got back to safety, I looked at the maps, and it was absolutely 180 degrees opposite direction to the direction I thought I was going. Sometimes we don't know directions. Sometimes we get confused the direction of our meditation, which is getting us working and peaceful, which is actually wasting our time. Our sense of direction in real life, in the mist, and in the Dhamma, is very dodgy and uncertain. So, when I saw that, I realized, yeah, you're in trouble. And I remembered some of the old Scottish people, you know, some of them, I hope there's no Scots people here, some of them, they do exaggerate. It's not really lying, they told me. We're not lying to you. We're just, you know, telling you what we want to have you believe. So, and sometimes they are stretching things a lot. But this time they were actually true, that people had been lost in that mist for days before they come out. And sometimes you die of hypothermia if you don't actually die of tripping over and breaking a leg or falling down cliffs. It was dangerous. So, I thought, how am I going to get out of this? And I used some of the Buddhism, but especially some of the science. I thought, water always flows downhill, and I've got to get downhill to get underneath the mist, underneath the clouds. So I found a little stream. And I said to myself, I don't care which way the stream goes, I am going to follow it. It curves around, it goes left, goes right, I'm going to follow it whichever way it goes because I know that's going to take me downhill. So, that's what I found, and the little stream met another stream, it came bigger, met some more streams, came bigger, and all the time I was going down, 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 until eventually I got so far down the mountain that I was underneath the mist, and now I could see. I could see all my directions. I was a long way from the hostel, but at least I could see which way to go now. And that's how I survived, obviously. And I used that experience with the Dhamma as well. So, for you to get wisdom, you know what the Buddha just said. That if it really is the Dhamma, If it's the teaching of the Buddha, it leads in a certain direction, just like water always leads downhill. If it leads to you letting go of more things, not getting more stuff, but not getting more sense of ego and pride and conceit and you know, getting a certificate at the end of the retreat and how well you've done and how many retreats you've done and how enlightened you are, that's going in the wrong direction. But if it's going in the correct direction, you're letting go of a lot of stuff, especially like past memories and old stuff which you really shouldn't be carrying around anymore, fears of the future. If it's going in that direction, it must be the Dhamma. If it's leading to more calm and more peacefulness, you're not thinking so much. You know, you're not worried so much. The mind is more calm and peaceful. And with that, more happy. Then you know you're going in the right direction. Becoming more aware, more awake. It's going in the right direction. So those are the things which you know that that is truth. Not just because it sounds right. Not because it's profound. Profound enough you can have a nice argument at the coffee table with your friends. No, but which actually works. And that becomes a great idea, the great sign of this is actually the Dhamma. This is good meditation. So sometimes I give all these little techniques, and sometimes they all work if you practice them properly, but sometimes people don't know how to practice them properly simply because old habits come up. Little things, like I said last night, don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose. Don't watch it at the belly, just watch the breath. But for many people, you've been watching the tip of the nose so many years that you're attached to that type of meditation, it's too difficult to let go. And watch at the tip of the nose. I was fortunate because of my hay fever. Sometimes sickness can be of great benefit to you. I was very fortunate that we had mosquitoes in Thailand. And the reason for that is they taught me so much that I had to let go of my body very quickly. Because when we meditate, this story of mosquitoes in Thailand, Ajahn Chah already mentioned just how he'd make us sit under the tin roof with all our robes on, boiling. I only learned later that's what the Japanese did to prisoners of war, to torture them. I don't know if that's where he got the idea from, but I wouldn't be able to get away with that these days with my monks, would I? No. They're much bigger than me. But when we started that international monastery over in Thailand, there was nothing there. No buildings at all. We'd sleep out on the ground. And in the evening, in order to get people to come there and support the place, Ajahn Chah would come every evening for the first month, and at 6 o'clock we'd do our 2-hour meditation, from 6 to 8, under the trees, in what was still then very much jungle. 6 to 8 p.m. is the worst time to sit out under the trees in the jungle. It might sound very romantic, just like the Buddha sitting under the tree. But the Buddha never sat under a tree in a jungle. It was in a park, next to the river, nice breezes and air. But we were in a jungle. Mosquitoes everywhere. And when did the mosquitoes come out? Between 6 to 8 p.m. when we were meditating. It was absolutely ridiculous, and he got bitten by so many mosquitoes. And together with one of my best friends at the time, his actual name was Jotiko, an American monk, and just, you know, something to do to endure those mosquitoes, we count them on our arm, and afterwards we compare who had the most. And you usually get into the 60s or 70s. All at one time. 60 mosquitoes. Because you have lots of space on your head, on your chin, and we had like bare shoulders, and you know, hands were bare. So many mosquitoes on you. And it was almost intolerable. Actually, it was intolerable. So sometimes, you know, you'd open up your eyes, because you couldn't swat them. And again, I told you earlier, just flick them off and they just come back and land again. You get two bites for one. So you just had to endure all those mosquitoes. And sometimes, you know, you'd open your eyes wanting to run away and you saw your teacher, Ajahn Chah. If he wasn't there, I would have run away. But you know, you feel so embarrassed. And your teacher's there. And he'd hardly ever get bitten. It's all right for him. But for us young monks, especially the Western monks, we always, honestly, we used to get much more bites than the Thais. Simply because apparently our blood vessels are closer to the skin. So, you know, it means that there's not so much to go through to get the blood. So anyway, you were sitting there being devoured. It's really irritating. And the only way to overcome that, which I learned thanks to mosquitoes, I could not wander around in my mind. If I wandered around, I'd go to my eyes, my head, and this terrible, you know, multiple itches happening. You know, the itch of the mosquito bite. It doesn't hurt, it's not dangerous, but it's just really, really irritating. So, I had to watch my breathing. The alternative was actually just being with your body, which was irritating. I had to go inside the breath and just let go of the body. And so just after a few minutes, I couldn't feel the arms at all. And because I didn't feel the arms on my head, I couldn't feel the mosquitoes. You escaped, you know, deep inside. And that to me was a great benefit. They taught me a lot about meditating to let go of the body. And one of the reasons I could do that is because of hay fever, I had learned how to watch my breath, not to watch my nose. Because if you're watching your nose, you're connected to the body. Your mind has still got the input coming from the fifth sense, physical touch, from the body. And it makes it very hard to let go of the body. But if you watch the feeling of the breath, are you breathing in, are you breathing out? And don't locate it anywhere in the body. You don't need to locate it in the body. You just know you're breathing in. Just that much. Anything else is extra. Not just harmless extra, but actually quite dangerous extra. Because you're focusing on part of the body. And that connection is still there. So yeah, you're focusing on your nose, but a mosquito lands on your ear and you feel it. So you're just focusing on the feeling of the breath and then you don't actually feel the mosquitoes. The body actually vanishes. So this is the next bit of the insight and the wisdom. You know, you let go of the body, but how actually does it disappear like that, thanks to Ajahn Mosquito? How it happens is the simile of the screen, which is, again, a great simile. I notice this, again, there's so much insight and understanding to get all over your life, not just when you're meditating. Insight, understanding, wisdom is out there in nature. Even in what some of you might think is you can't really call nature at all, on the inside of an aircraft cabin, sitting down in economy class, having to watch the in-flight safety movies, or with the demonstrations. And you had to do that. So I noticed something interesting. When I watched that little screen, when the safety demonstration movie came up, when I first looked at that screen, I could see the upholstery of the seat in front of me and even the plastic border of the TV screen. But I noticed after a few seconds, when you're watching the safety demonstration video, I couldn't see the upholstery anymore, nor could I see the plastic cover. My mind had actually fat inside the screen. Just, it was like it just fat perfectly. So it was just inside. It didn't go too close because I didn't see the nose of the airline pilot, you know, doing the demonstration. No, it just fat just inside the screen. So I couldn't see the borders or anything extraneous. And I've noticed that with people's what's it called, the big LCD screen TVs, which are huge these days. But it doesn't matter because when you turn it on, your mind just fits perfectly inside that screen. So you just don't see the borders or what's beyond it. It doesn't go narrower than that. It's called focusing. And noticing that phenomena, realize that's actually how you can overcome many of the distractions of life, such as mosquitoes. You have your screen, your mind, your mental image in your mind. Make sure that the most important things are in the center. Say you're breathing, not your nose, you're breathing. And after a while, your mind just fits in with the breath. It doesn't feel the nose falls off the screen and with it the rest of the body. Which is the phenomena many of you have experienced. You're meditating, you may be fantasizing or dreaming or planning, but you can't feel your legs. You can't feel the sore back. You can't feel, you might start meditating and it's too hot for you in this room. Or you might start meditating and it's too cold for you in this room, but that soon disappears. The temperature hasn't changed, your body hasn't adapted, you just let it go, it's fallen off the screen, so you're not aware of it. So that idea of a screen and focusing on the center is so helpful. So when I get to my breath, just watching the breath, everything else just falls off. So you can't feel your legs, you can't feel your arms or your head. So a mosquito can be eating it up, you wouldn't know about it. You're just focusing inside. And that's also really helpful if you have any distractions at all. Even distractions of sounds, people banging the doors, people talking, vehicles going around. Don't put those in the center of your screen. If somebody starts snoring during your meditation, don't put that in the center of your screen. If you put that in the center, your breath, everything else falls off. And you start worrying about it. Who is that? I'm going to find their name. I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to tell Bianca. We're going to put them on the blacklist. I'm going to go and talk to them. If you want to sleep, go in your room to sleep. Not in the meditation area. This is meditation. You're disturbing everybody else. What would have happened if somebody started snoring when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree? We wouldn't have a Buddha. We wouldn't have anything. So please, this is my meditation retreat. I sacrificed a lot to get here. You shouldn't be snoring when I'm trying to meditate. This is my chance to get jhanas, a chance to get enlightened, and you're spoiling it. You should never be able to be here again. So your breath, your meditation was falling off the screen a long time ago. And you've put right in the center this little distraction. And you know that, that's why you were laughing, you've done that before. So instead, just keep the breath, and you can hear the snoring, it's over here somewhere. You can hear the bang of the doors, it's over there somewhere, but it's not centered. Just like the upholstery in the back of the economy class seat, after a while it vanishes. You can't see it anymore. They can be snoring, you don't hear it. They can be making a noise, you can't feel it. You can have a mosquito on you, you don't even feel it. Just like that anecdote of this Malaysian Chinese couple living in Perth. And they told me that they were watching a movie at home. And when the movie finished, one got up to turn the kettle on to make a cup of tea, the other one went to the toilet. So when they got up from the sofa on which they were watching the TV, they noticed their living room, their lounge room, looked different. There were things, valuable things, missing. It's a classic story. Just right behind the sofa on the shelf, many things had gone. The burglar had come into their house, and this is, I'm not exaggerating, had come into their house while they were watching the movie, right behind their sofa. There's a cheeky burglar, but he got away with it. And I thank him, because he gave me another great story for my talks. Whoever that burglar is, you know, I'll say three sadhus to you later on. Not for burglary, I'm not sort of trying to encourage burglary, but just, you know, great anecdote. And they were so focused on the movie, that that filled the whole screen, and they just literally could not hear anything else. Even a burglar right behind them, taking stuff. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, or you know other people, but that's apparently quite common sometimes. They're really into the movie. You can't feel anything. You can't hear anything. Except the movie. That is why. You wives, your husband may be watching a football match, and you say to him, darling, dinner's ready. He's not ignoring you, but you are off the screen, wife. He's so focused. So don't think he's, you know, willfully just giving you a hard time. He just can't hear you. Or Sri Lankans and cricket matches. So, I told them, oh, if you could only focus that much on your breathing so you didn't hear any other sounds, you'd be great meditators. But anyway, that's actually how it works. When you really focus on something in the center, everything else on the outside falls off. So you're focusing on your breathing, not on your nose. Actually, your nose falls off the screen. You can't feel anything. Your body's gone. And I don't know how healthy or sick you are, how young or how old you are, but certainly I'm reasonably healthy, don't have too much wrong with my body, but still, it aches, it's hard to get up, it's just old age getting creaky. So, oh, there's nothing so nice as sitting here and saying bye-bye to my 65-year-old body. Bye-bye. I'm leaving you here sitting and I'm going deep inside, going onto my breath, and you're going to vanish. And it does. Oh, what joy. There's always an ache here somewhere, an itch somewhere else. Oh, you've got to straighten your back, and now you've got to loosen it. You've got to scratch your ear. You've got to move your leg. You've got to move your other leg. You've got to scratch your nose or wipe your nose. And I'm just describing what I'm seeing right in front of me right now. So that's why everybody's body is so irritating. You always have to move or do something with it. You did it again, didn't you? And even the mic just goes wrong. You see how difficult it is to be still? Because the body is always irritating. But when it vanishes, oh, that's so much bliss. I can just watch my breath and just, body, you're gone, I'm not dealing with you. And my body's much healthier when I don't bother with it. This is another weird thing about meditation. You know, sometimes you sit for an hour, you're a bit stiff. That's why when I give a talk, because you're not going deep inside, afterwards, oh, it's a bit stiff here, a bit stiff there. But you meditate for a couple of hours, even 3 hours, 4 hours. You do these long meditations and you come out afterwards, oh God, this is going to hurt. If I'm stiff after 1 hour, what's it going to be like after 4 hours of meditating? Oh. But you get up, there's not an ache or a pain in the body. That's really amazing. To see just, yeah, you let the body alone, you get into some deep meditation, everything balances out so beautifully. So nothing is as nice. You have a nice deep meditation, you come out and your body is great. No aches, no pains anywhere. So don't be afraid. The longer you sit, the more it's going to hurt when it ends. It's the opposite. So anyway, we're learning how to let go of our body in this meditation. By getting the mindfulness and wisdom, renouncing our body. Getting some peace, calming it so it vanishes. And that's where stillness is so important. When things are still, they disappear. That's the great insight which we focused on in The Art of Disappearing. Stillness comes first, and then things vanish. So, you close your eyes. And first of all, you see the blackness of the inside of your eyelids, or sometimes red if there's a light shining. But, because that doesn't change, because it is still, it vanishes. Sight turns off. And sound. You don't have to have it perfectly silent. Can you hear the aircon now? The hum of the aircon. How long are you going to be able to be aware of the hum of the aircon? In a few seconds it will disappear. Why? Because it doesn't change. It is still. People smell. You all smell. Ask any dog. They know the difference between each one of you. You've all got your different smells. But because it doesn't change that much, unless you've eaten baked beans this morning like I did, then you are safe. Which is one of the reasons why, if you do have stomach problems and you're passing a lot of gas, please practice wisdom and compassion. Sit in the back. Because if you sit in the front and you fart, not just the person in the next row, the one behind you and the one after that, they have to suffer. But if you sit against the wall or in the back, then just know the wall is the only thing which can smell you. So please, out of compassion, if you do have stomach problems today, please sit in the back. And I always say that now you know why the same people sit in the back every day. Because they got stomach problems. I love being gross. But if it doesn't change, then it disappears. Smell, taste, turns off. And your body, that's one of the hardest things to turn off. You have to keep it still. And after a while, focus on the breathing. And after a while, it just vanishes, disappears. So that's what I learned from Ajahn Mosquito. They taught me how to do that because I had to. I couldn't mess around. Couldn't go thinking and fantasizing or dreaming about the future or the past. Had to really do my meditation properly. And of course it works. Beautiful stuff. So maybe we should, for the next retreat or tomorrow, maybe I'll see if I can go to the University Biological Society or whatever and get a big can of mosquitoes and release them in this hall. Would that be a good idea? But sometimes people used to do these strange things. But I all heard in the first couple of years in Thailand about a very famous monastery in Laos. And this was before the Vietnam War and when Laos was taken over by the communists. And they told me, a few of the monks actually told me, and one in particular, he told me what they did. You know, this was not for cream puffs, this monastery, because the abbot, the meditation teacher, he would take all the new recruits on a walk through the jungle. You know, and this is not just jungle, this is mountains as well, up and down, up and down. And you know, by the afternoon you were really hot and tired. You just wanted to go back to your room and just rest. But rest was not an option. Because in the mid-afternoon, maybe an hour or two before sunset, he'd always come to this place in the jungle with these really tall trees, magnificent trees. And high up in one of those branches of those huge trees, they had built little platforms. The platform was made out of wood, and it was exactly the same size as these little mats which you're sitting on. With no railings, just a flat piece of wood, just big enough for you to cross your legs and sit upright on. And there were big bamboo ladders where the new monk had to climb on that ladder and sit on the platform. And then the teacher took the ladder away and said, "I'll be back in the morning." And all these monks, they've been working or walking all day in the hot, up and down the mountains, exhausted, tired. They had to sit there all night. They couldn't lay down. It was not big enough to lay down. They couldn't climb down. There was no ladders left anymore. It was huge, tall trees. All night they sat there. And they said they got amazing meditation. Those that lived to tell the tale. We never heard of the ones who didn't make it, who fell asleep, fell to their death. But that was going a bit far. But it's amazing, if you really have to, sometimes you can. Really strange. If you really must, you do. You can just go deep inside and go into great meditations. But I can't get away with that here, because in Australia we have something called occupational health and safety. I'd be put in jail for trying something like that. So anyway, you can understand that if it's important, you can let go. It's not willpower, but wisdom power. You have to, so you do it. You let go. Just focus on the breath. Nice screen. In the center, everything else just vanishes. Because it's still, it disappears. And that becomes just the path. So we, going down the mountain, more peace, more stillness, more wakefulness. All the energy, again, which gets wasted in your body, can now go into your mind. Just get wasted by doing stuff. Just goes into mindfulness, awareness. And there is where you get some incredible, beautiful, deep meditations. So this is about, so the stillness part of it. Your mindfulness, but you're also understanding why you're doing this, how it works, what is happening here. It's still the case, I remember, that some people, they meditate and they come to see me in the interviews. They're terrified, they want to leave. I say, why? What's happened? When I was meditating, my hands disappeared. So they're supposed to disappear. But what's going to happen to them? Is it some neurological disease? Is it the start of like motor neurone disease where you lose all sensitivity to your hands? So it's really important that I say these things. You've got nothing to worry about. Sometimes when strange things happen, people get afraid because they don't know whether they're going in the right direction or not. And sometimes people go in the right direction, they get these beautiful experiences because they haven't heard of them before. They just stop it proceeding and they lose great opportunities. So that's one of the reasons I have to talk like this. And just to give you that basic piece of advice, if it leads to renunciation, letting go of stuff, that has to be the right path. If you feel more peaceful, more still, more relaxed, that has to be the right path. That's the Dhamma. If it leads to wakening up, being alert, that has to be the right Dhamma. If it leads to this beautiful sense of freedom, that's the right Dhamma. That's the teaching. So this is how you can find out from yourself. People always ask, have this teacher and that teacher, should I go to many different teachers? I say, why not? When you're at university, you had many different teachers for chemistry, many different teachers for science. Yeah, but you don't have to believe everything they say. Just like the buffet. You don't have to take everything which is on the lunch tables today. Just, you know, unless you're really a greedy pig. But just take what you feel is good for you. Just like the Dhamma teachings. So you can get other teachers and get something good from them. And they just balance each other. And they should never be contradictory. Never putting one another down, but be more like the blind man and the elephant. You just combine your understanding. And you know that story that the blind men come to the conclusion, instead of arguing, that an elephant is four tree trunks, on top of which is a stone. And on top of the stone, up a bit, is a water pot. On the other side of the water pot, there are two ploughs, that's the trunks. In the middle, a snake, that's the trunk. And on the edges, the two big fans, the ears. And on the back of the rock, there's a fly whisk. And if you can visualize that, that's a pretty good description of an elephant for someone who never see it. So why don't we combine our understandings instead of competing? Respect each other's understandings and views. And that way, if it's leading to peace, if it's leading to renunciation, if it's leading to wisdom, I'll put that aside for a minute because people don't know what wisdom is. And if it leads to the opening of the mind, great, that's wisdom. And the last little thing is, when it comes to wisdom, How do we know it's really true or not? I always say the flower pot experiment, that was pretty scary. You think it's real, but you're not really seeing it. You're seeing what you want to see. Or you're in denial to what offends you. Wanting aversion. Or what prevent wisdom. Otherwise known as the first two hindrances. So, when the Buddha started talking about hindrances, these are not just hindrances to meditation. They are weakeners of wisdom. They stop wisdom happening. So you just see what you want to see. So if one can let go of wanting and aversion, then there's a good chance you see what's real, what's true. Not what you want to see, not what confirms your views, but sometimes what turns you totally upside down, seeing things you never expected to see before. That is wisdom. It takes courage. That is why somebody asked me in the questions or interviews, I forget which, about where does effort, energy, virya come into these teachings? And all I ever tell you to do is to let go. And where it comes in is that word virya, it comes from another Pali word, vira, which is the hero. It's a word which was usually derived from military experiences of the hero going into battle for the king or for the country or whatever it was you believed in and sacrificing your life for the cause. Not keeping anything back for yourself but sacrificing everything. That was the idea in Indian philosophy of the hero. Willing to let go of everything. That is where virya comes from. It's not just energy and effort. It's a type of energy and effort. The ability to renounce and let go of everything. Even more than your life. All your old views and conceits. That is one of the hardest things to sacrifice. So we talk about letting go, this huge letting go is required. Not keeping anything back, being able to, willing to sacrifice everything for the truth. That is why we practice to let go. The mindfulness, the wisdom, the stillness, the mindfulness, the wisdom, the stillness, all growing together until those hindrances. You don't want anything. You're not averse to anything. Whatever comes up, you allow to happen. You let it be. And that means you're open to seeing the Dhamma. And you know it's on the right path because it always leads to more peace, to more stillness, to more awakening. That is the path of wisdom. Okay, that's the 9 o'clock. Today I'm going to finish on time. I didn't do that the last two times yesterday, but today I am. I've got another 1 minute to go. Close enough. Sadhu! 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 Don't rush things. Sadhu! Okay, very good. So I wish you a pleasant morning. And anyway, if it doesn't work this morning, if your meditation is shit this morning, don't worry. You have got lunch to look forward to. Coming at 11. Keep a positive mind.
Back again. Mm-hmm.